Chapter 15. Trouble. I jumped as if I'd been struck by a whip.
Finkaira?
Rhea eyed me with interest.
You have heard of it?
Yes. Someone told me a little, but I never imagined it could be real. She sighed somberly.
Finkaira is real enough.
So it is, I thought to myself. As real as a Wythfa. As real as Olympus, if only I could tell Branwyn. I tried to call back what she had said about Finkaira. A place of many wonders, she had called it. Neither holy of earth nor holy of heaven, but a bridge connecting both. She had mentioned bright colors, too. That part I knew was true. And something else. Something about giants. As we sat together in silence, immersed in private thoughts, the blanket of evening began to envelop the garden of the Shemora. With each passing minute, colors became shadows and shapes became silhouettes. Finally, Rhea stirred. She rubbed her back against the trunk.
Night already. We have no time to travel to my house.
Feeling drowsy after our feast, I slid lower on the bed of soft grass beneath the tree. I have slept in worse places.
Look!
Rhea pointed to the sky where the first stars glimmered through the branches laden with fruit.
Wouldn't you love to be able to fly? To sail among those stars, to be one with the wind? I wish I had wings, real wings.
So do I replied, searching for some sign of Pegasus. She turned to me.
What else do you wish for?
Well, books.
Really?
Yes, I would love, really love, to bury myself in a whole room of books, with stories from all peoples, all times. I heard about such a room once. She watched me for a moment.
From your mother?
I drew a long breath. No, from a woman who wanted me to believe that she was. Rhea seemed puzzled, but said nothing. The room, I continued, would have every kind of book imaginable, surrounding me everywhere I turned. Being in a room like that would be a lot like flying, you know. I could fly through those pages anywhere I like. Rhea laughed.
I'd rather have real wings, especially on a night like this. See?
She looked up through the branches.
You can already see Guri of the Golden Hair.
That's a new constellation for me. Where is it?
Right there.
Though I strained with my second sight, I could see nothing in that part of the sky but a single star that I knew would eventually become part of Pegasus' wing. I don't see it.
Can't you see a maiden?
No. She took my arm and aimed it upward.
Now?
No. All I see is a star that will be part of Pegasus, and there I can see another star for Pegasus. Rhea shot me a puzzled look.
Stars? Constellations of stars?
Puzzled myself, I demanded. What else?
My constellations are not made from the stars, but from the spaces between the stars, the dark places, the open places where your mind can travel forever and ever.
From that instant onward, I could not view the heavens in the same way, just as I could not view the girl beside me in the same way. Tell me more about what you see up there. Rhea tossed back her brown curls. In a lilting voice, she began to explain some of the strange wonders of the Finkaeran sky, how the broad band of stars across the middle of the night sky was truly a seam sewn in the two halves of time, one half always beginning, the other half always ending, how the longest patches of darkness were really the rivers of the gods, connecting this world and others. How the spinning circle of the stars was actually a great wheel whose endless revolutions turned life into death, death into life. Late into the night, we drew pictures in the sky and traded tales. When at last we slept, it was soundly. And when warm rays awoke us, we realized that we did not want to leave this place, not yet. So for another day and another night we lingered at the bountiful hilltop, feasting on fruit and conversation. Though I remained guarded about discussing my deepest feelings, I discovered more than once that Rhea had an unnerving way of reading my thoughts as if they had been her own. We sat beneath the fruity canopy, eating a hearty breakfast of tangy orange spheres for me and sweet red berries for her. As we finished the meal by sharing one of the spiral-shaped fruits, Rhea turned to me with a question.
That woman, the one who said she was your mother? What was she like?
I looked at her with surprise. She was tall, with very blue...
No, I don't care what she looked like. What was she like?
For a moment, I considered Bronwyn. Well, she was kind to me. More kind than I deserved. Most of the time, anyway. Full of faith in her God and in me. And quiet, too quiet. Except when she told me stories. She knew a lot of stories, more than I can begin to remember. Rhea examined a berry for a moment before dropping it into her mouth.
I'm sure she learned some of them in that room full of books.
That's right.
And even though she wasn't your real mother, did you feel different because she was there beside you? A little less lonely? A little safer?
I swallowed. I guess so. Why are you so curious about her? Her face, which usually seemed at the very edge of laughter, turned serious.
I was just wondering what a mother, a real mother, would be like.
I lowered my eyes. I wish I knew. Rhea nodded. She ran her hand along a drooping bough of fruit, though she seemed to be looking past it to some place or time far away. So you don't remember your mother?
I was so very young when I lost her. I only remember feelings, being safe and warm and held. I'm not even sure I really remember those things. It might just be my longing for them.
What about your father? Any brothers or sisters?
I lost them, all of them.
She spread her arms to the branches above us.
But I found the Druma. This is my family now. And while I don't have a true mother, I do have someone who protects me and holds me. She is almost my mother.
Who is that? Rhea smiled.
A tree. A tree named Arbasa.
I imagined her seated in the boughs of a great, sturdy tree, and I, too, smiled. Then I thought about Bronwyn, my own almost mother, as a strange warmth filled my chest. She was so distant from me, and yet, at times, so close. I thought about her stories, her healing work, her sorrowful eyes. I wished that she had been willing to share more about her own struggles as well as my mysterious past. I hoped that I might see her once again someday, although I knew it could not be so. Haltingly, I said a silent prayer to the God to whom she prayed so often, a prayer that wished her the peace she so longed to find. Suddenly, a sharp whistle pierced the air above my head. I looked up to find a familiar form perched on one of the branches. I don't believe it.
A merlin, observed Rhea. A young male, and look! His wing is hurt. See how it's missing some feathers?
She twitched her neck, in the way a hawk often does, and released a sharp whistle of her own. The bird, cocking his head, whistled back. This time the whistle warbled a bit, incorporating some more throaty tones. Rhea's thick eyebrows lifted. She turned to me.
He said to me, not very politely, I might add, that you saved his life a while ago.
He told you that?
Is it not true?
Yes, it's true. I patched him up after he got into a fight. But how did you learn to talk with birds? Rhea shrugged as if the answer were obvious.
It's no more difficult than talking with trees,
she added a bit sadly.
Those that are still awake, that is. Anyway, who was the merlin fighting?
I couldn't believe his pluck or foolishness. He picked a fight with two giant rats, each of them at least three times his size.
Giant rats?
Rhea's whole body stiffened.
Where? In the Druma?
I shook my head. No, but right on the edge, near a little stream that flows out of the trees. Gravely, Rhea glanced at the merlin who was pecking ravenously at a spiral-shaped fruit.
Killer rats on our side of the river,
she muttered, shaking her head.
They are forbidden to enter Druma Wood. That's the first time I've heard of them so close. Your friend the merlin may not have any manners, but he was right to attack them.
That bird just likes fighting, if you ask me. It could just as easily have been you or me that he attacked. He's no friend of mine. As if to contradict me, the Merlin fluttered down from the fruit and landed on my left shoulder. Kriya laughed.
Looks like he disagrees with you,
she observed the hawk thoughtfully.
It's possible, you know, that he came to you for a reason.
I grimaced. The only reason is the same bad luck that follows me everywhere.
I don't know. He doesn't seem like such bad luck to me.
Whistling in a light, friendly cadence, she extended her hand toward the Merlin. With a screech, the bird lashed out with one of his talons. Rhea quickly withdrew, though not before the talon sliced across the back of her hand.
Ow!
Scowling, she licked the blood from her wound, then whistled a sharp reprimand. The Merlin reprimanded her in return. Stop that, I barked. I tried to brush the Merlin off my shoulder, but the talons held tight, piercing my tunic and digging into my skin.
You keep him away from me, declared
Rhea.
That bird is trouble.
I told you so.
Don't act so smug.
She got up to leave.
Just rid us of him.
I rose also, with the unwanted passenger still on my shoulder. Can't you help me somehow?
He's your friend.
She stalked off, heading down the hill. Again, I tried to remove the Merlin, but he refused to budge. Fixing an eye on me, he whistled angrily as if he were threatening to tear off my ear if I did not cooperate. Growling with frustration, I ran after Rhea as she disappeared into the forest. The bird clung tight to my shoulder, wings flapping. When I finally caught up with her, she was sitting on a low, rectangular rock, licking her gash.
I don't suppose you could fix my hand the way you fixed your friend's wing.
He's not my friend. I shook my left shoulder, but the Merlin hung on, eyeing me coldly. Can't you see? It's more like he's my master and I'm his slave. I glared at the bird. I can't make him leave. Rhea's expression turned sympathetic.
I'm sorry, it's just that my hand hurts so.
Let me see it. I took her hand, studying the deep cut. Blood continued to flow. Swiftly, I reached into my satchel and sprinkled some of the powdered herbs into the open wound. Pulling a broad leaf off a nearby bush, I laid it over the gash, taking care to draw the skin together as I had seen Branwen do dozens of times. Then, using a vine from Hria's own sleeve, I wrapped her hand securely. She lifted her hand gratefully.
Where did you learn to do this?
From Branwen, the woman who told me stories. She knew a lot about healing. I closed the satchel. But she could only heal wounds to the skin. Rhea nodded.
Wounds to the heart are much more difficult.
Where are you going next?
To my house. I hope you will come.
She waved at the hawk, who raised a vicious talon in response.
Even with your, companion there.
Generous of you, I replied grimly. Despite the bothersome bird, my curiosity to learn more about this place and about Rhea herself remains strong. I would like to come, but I won't stay for long.
That's fine. As long as you take that bird with you when you go.
Do I have any choice? With that, we strode into the forest. For the rest of that morning and well into the afternoon, we followed a trail only visible to Rhea. We rounded hills, leapt streams, and slogged through marshes where the air hummed with all kinds of insects. Halfway across one such marsh, Rhea pointed to a dead tree that seemed to be painted bright red. She clapped her hands once. A split second later, a scarlet cloud billowed out of its branches. Butterflies, hundreds of them, thousands of them, rose into the air, leaving the tree as bare as a skeleton. I watched the scarlet cloud rise. So bright were the wings of the butterflies flashing in the sun that I wondered whether slices of the sun itself had been set like jewels within them. And I began to hope that my second sight was continuing to improve. If I could see such a stunning burst of color as this without my eyes, then one day, perhaps, I might be able to see all the world's colors as vividly as I had seen them before the fire. On we went, stepping through glades of hip-high fern, crossing over tumbled trees whose trunks and limbs were melting steadily into soil, passing beneath roaring waterfalls. When we paused to gather some berries or to take a drink of water, it was only briefly. Yet those moments were always long enough to glimpse the tail of a scurrying beast, catch the spicy scent of a flower, or hear the several voices of a stream. I did my best to keep up, although Rhea's pace and my poor vision in shadowy places kept my chest heaving and my shins bruised. All the while, the bird continued to pinch my shoulder. I started to doubt that those talons would ever let me go. As the late afternoon light wove luminous threads through the loom of branches, Rhea came to a sudden halt. I approached, huffing, to find her looking up at the trunk of a linden tree. There, wrapped around the middle of the trunk, hung a spiky wreath of glittering gold. "What is it?" I asked in wonderment. Rhea smiled at me.
"Mistletoe, the golden bough. See how it holds the light of the sun? It is said that one who wears a mantle of mistletoe may find the secret path to the other world of the spirits."
"It's beautiful," she nodded.
"Second only to the long-tailed Achlia bird, it's the most beautiful sight in the forest."
I studied the shining wreath. "It seems so different from other plants."
"And so it is. It's neither a plant nor a tree, but a little of both. It's something in between."
"Something in between," I repeated to myself, remembering the words. Once Bronwyn had used them to describe those special places, like the Greeks' Mount Olympus, where mortals and immortals could live side by side. And those special substances, like mist, where elements as distinct as air and water could merge to form something both alike and unlike themselves. Something in between. Rhea beckoned.
"We should go. We will need to move quickly to reach my house before dark."
Through the towering trees we marched. As the light grew dim, my ability to see grew worse, as did my bruises and scrapes. Despite Rhea's repeated urgings, I lost speed in the darkening forest. I stumbled more and more often, tripping on roots and rocks. Every time I fell, the Merlin dug in his talons and screeched at me angrily, so loud that my ear stung as much as my shoulder. The trek became a torture. At one point, I misjudged a branch and walked straight into it. The branch jabbed one of my sightless eyes. I howled in pain, but Rhea was too far ahead to hear. Then, trying to regain my balance, I did not see an animal's den and stepped in it, twisting my ankle. I crumpled on a fallen trunk, my eyes stinging and my ankle throbbing. I lowered my head toward my knees, prepared to wait out the night if necessary. To my surprise, the Merlin finally lifted off. An instant later, he pounced on a mouse, bit the creature's neck in two, then carried it aloft. He landed next to me on the trunk and began attacking his meal. While sorry for the mouse, I rubbed my sore shoulder thankfully. But my relief was muted. I felt sure that the bird, who continued to eye me even as he ate, would soon return to his favorite perch. Why, of all places in this entire forest, did he have to choose my poor shoulder?
"Emrys!"
"Over here," I answered dismally. Even the sound of Rhea's voice failed to lift my spirits, for I did not look forward to telling her that I could not see well enough to go any farther that night. I heard a crackling of twigs, and she appeared out of the darkness. Suddenly I realized that she had not come alone. Beside her stood a slight figure, thin as a sapling, whose long face remained hidden in shadow, and although I could not be sure, the figure seemed to exude a potent fragrance, as sweet as apple blossoms in the spring. I rose to meet them. My ankle felt somewhat stronger, but I still wobbled unsteadily. With the onset of night, I could see less well by the minute. Rhea indicated her thin companion.
"This is Kuwain, my oldest friend. She took care of me when I was young."
"So young you could not speak, nor even feed yourself,"
whispered Kuwain in a voice like the wind rustling a field of dry grasses. Sounding wistful, she added,
"You were as young then as I am old now."
She pointed a narrow, knobby arm at me.
"And who is this?"
At that instant, a deafening whistle and a flapping of wings filled the air, followed by a shriek from Kuen. Rhea swatted at something, then pulled her friend away. I myself cried out as sharp talons closed once more on my left shoulder.
Ah!
Hissed Kuen, glaring at the Merlin.
That thing attacks me.
Furious, Rhea whistled at the bird, yet he merely cocked his head at her, not even bothering to respond. Rhea glared at me.
That bird is trouble, nothing but trouble.
With a glance at my shoulder, I nodded glumly. I wish I knew how to lose him.
Skewer him,
urged Kuen, keeping her distance.
Pluck out his feathers.
The Merlin ruffled his pointed wings, and she fell silent. Rhea scratched her chin thoughtfully.
This bird reminds me of a shadow, the way he sticks to you.
He reminds me more of a curse, I grumbled.
Hear me out, Rhea went on. Is there any possibility, no matter how small, that you might be able to tame him?
Are you insane?
I am serious.
But why should I want to tame him?
Because if you can come to know him even a little, you might find out what he really wants, and then you might find some way to free yourself from him.
Kuen scoffed.
Nonsense.
As the darkness closed in, I didn't feel at all hopeful. It will never work.
Do you have a better idea?
I shook my head. I suppose if I'm going to try to tame him, and I would have better luck taming a dragon, I think, then I should first give him a name.
Right,
agreed Rhea.
But the name will be tricky. It must be something fitting.
I groaned. That part is easy. You just said it yourself. The name for him is Trouble, nothing but Trouble.
Good. Now you can start his training.
Dejectedly, I turned to the dark form on my shoulder.
Come then,
said Rhea as she took Kuen's thin arm.
We are only a few hundred paces from my house.
I brightened a bit. Really?
Yes. You are welcome there, so long as that bird is not too much
trouble,
finished Kuen. Chapter 16. Arbasa's Door. As Rhea led us out of the deep forest into a nearby clearing, I noticed the sudden brightness of the night sky. Then, as the web of branches fell away, I wondered whether a star might be exploding above us, filling the sky with light. At once I realized that the light came not from a star, nor even from the sky. It came from Rhea's house. From the center of the clearing rose a great oak, mightier than any tree I had ever seen. Its burly branches reached outward and upward from the trunk, so thick that it seemed to be made of several trunks fused together. Set in the midst of those branches, glowing like a giant torch, was an aerial cottage whose beams and walls and windows curled with the twisting limbs. Layers of leaves overlaid the treehouse, so that the light radiating from its windows shone through multiple curtains of green.
Arbasa!
Rhea lifted her arms high as she spoke the name. In response, the branches above her head shimmered just enough to drop a light rain of dew on her upturned face. I watched, my chest feeling warm again, as Rhea approached the base of the tree. Peeling off her snug shoes, which appeared to be made of a leathery type of bark, she stepped into a cup-shaped portion of the massive roots. As she spoke a quiet, swishing phrase, the root gradually closed around her feet, so that she and the tree stood planted together as one single being. Rhea stretched her arms wide and embraced the great trunk, even though she could only reach a tiny portion of the way around. At the same time, one of the tree's enormous branches unfurled like the frond of a fern, wrapping itself over her back to return the embrace. A few moments later, the branch lifted and the root parted. With a creaking sound, the trunk creased, cracked, and opened into a small doorway. Rhea ducked her head and entered. Kuen, walking stiffly, slipped in beside her.
Come,
Rhea motioned to me to join her. As I stepped toward the cavern, however, the tree shuddered. The bark-edged doorway began to close. Rhea shouted a sharp command, but the tree ignored her and continued to seal itself. I called out to her, while Trouble fluttered his wings nervously. Despite Rhea's protests, the doorway shut tight. Helpless, I stood before the tree. I knew as little about what this meant as I knew what to do about it, but one thing was clear. I had been rejected. No doubt, thanks to the troublesome bird on my shoulder. Just then the trunk creased again. The door reopened. Rhea, her face red from shouting, beckoned me to come. Glancing uncertainly at the fidgeting bird, I entered the dark cavern. Rhea said nothing. She merely turned and started to climb the spiraling stairway within the trunk. I followed, hoping that Trouble would not cause any. The gnarled platforms of the stairs grew right out of the inner walls of the trunk, so that the whole stairway smelled as rich and moist as a glade after a rain. As we climbed higher, the stairs grew lighter, revealing intricately carved script that flowed over the inner walls. Thousands of lines of this tightly written script covered the stairwell, as beautiful as it was indecipherable. I wished I could read what it said. At last we reached an open platform. Rhea pushed against a drapery of leaves and entered her house. I came right behind, although Trouble clawed angrily at the leaves when they brushed against his feathers. I found myself standing on a floor of tightly meshed boughs, sturdy yet uneven. A fire burned in the hearth in the middle of the room, so bright that I wondered what fuel could be burning within it. The branches of the great tree curled around us, though they were not as closely woven as the floor, so that window slats opened in all directions. Every piece of furniture in this one-room house rose out of the branches as naturally as the branches themselves sprang from the trunk. A low table by the hearth, a pair of simple chairs, a cabinet containing utensils made of carved wood and beeswax, all were produced by living branches twisted into shape. Next to the cabinet, Kuwain was stirring something. I stepped closer to Rhea. What happened down there? Cautiously, she looked from me to the sharp-taloned bird on my shoulder.
My friend Arbasa did not want to let you in.
That much I could tell.
It would only have done that for one reason, to keep out of my home someone who could do me great harm.
I felt a new surge of resentment against Trouble. If his presence had almost prevented me from entering Rhea's house, might it also prevent me from finding my past, my identity? I wish I'd never met this cursed bird. Rhea frowned.
Yes, I know.
She waved toward Kuwain, still bending over the cabinet.
Come, let's have some supper.
The slim figure poured something that looked like honey over her concoction, a platter of rolled leaves crammed with reddish-brown nuts. The whole thing gave off a hearty roasted smell. As she carried the platter over to the low table by the hearth, she glanced sharply at Trouble.
I have no supper for that vicious beast.
For the first time, I realized that Kuwain was truly more tree than human. Her skin, gnarled and ridged, looked very much like bark, while her tangled brown hair resembled a mass of vines. Her root-like feet remained unshod, and she wore no adornment but the silver rings on the smallest of her 12 knobby fingers. Beneath her robe of white cloth, her body moved like a tree bending with the wind. Yet her age must have been considerable, for her back bent like a trunk leaning under a winter's weight of snow, and her neck, arms, and legs seemed twisted and frail. Even so, the fragrance of apple blossoms wafted around her, and her recessed brown eyes, shaped like slender teardrops, shone as bright as the fire. Staying clear of me, and especially my passenger, she set down the platter. Her aim was off, however, and she knocked over an oaken flask of water on the table.
Curse these old hands.
Kuwain grabbed the flask and brought it over to the cabinet. As she refilled it, I heard her muttering,
The curse of time.
the curse of time.
She continued to grumble as she returned it to the table. Priya sat in one of the chairs, indicating with a nod for me to take the other. I watched as she took one of the rolled leaves in her hand. This she plunged into the jar of honey on the platter. She flashed me a slightly guilty smile.
A person can never get enough honey.
I grinned. Tilting my head toward Kuwain, I whispered,
She is not a person like you or me, is she?
Rhea looked at me curiously.
A person she certainly is, but like us she is not. She is the last survivor of the Treelings, a race of part trees, part people. They used to be common in Finkaira, back in the days when giants were the masters of this land. But they are gone now, except for Kuwain.
She stuffed the food, dripping with honey, into her mouth, then reached for the flask of water. After several swallows, she offered it to me. Since by then I had tried some myself and found the rolled leaves so sticky that they were very difficult to chew, I accepted the water gladly. As I replaced the flask on the table, I noticed that the fire, intensely bright though it was, produced no smoke and no heat. In a flash, I understood that this fire was really not a fire at all. Thousands of tiny beetles, pulsing with light of their own making, crawled across a pile of rounded river stones in the center of the hearth. The stones appeared to be their home, for the beetles crawled over and under them continuously, like bees in a hive. While each one of the beetles comprised only a subtle spot of light, collectively they produced a powerful glow which illuminated the entire treehouse. As I finally swallowed the sticky food, trouble shifted on my shoulder, digging his talons deep into my skin. I cried out, then turned angrily toward him.
"Why do you punish me like this? Get off my shoulder, I say. Get off!"
Trouble merely stared at me, unblinking. I turned to Rhea.
How am I supposed to tame him? Not even the Galator could tame him.
Kuwain, standing near one of the window slats, stiffened. Caught off guard, I instinctively touched the tunic over my chest, feeling the pendant hanging beneath. Then, realizing what I had done, I did my best to disguise the motion, reaching higher to rub my free shoulder. In a casual voice, I said to Rhea,
Wouldn't it be wonderful to find something magical like the Galator?
But if I ever did, I wouldn't waste it on the bird. I'd use it to mend my sore body. Rhea nodded sympathetically.
Where are you sore?
My legs, mostly. But I also have this ache between my shoulder blades. It's been with me for as long as I can remember. Her eyebrows lifted, but she remained silent. I somehow had the feeling that she, too, knew more than she was saying. She reached beneath the table and pulled out two small silvery blankets, made from the most delicate linen I had ever seen. She spread one over her thighs, then handed the other to me.
A good night's sleep will help.
I held the shimmering blanket up to the light.
What is this cloth?
It is silk made by moths.
Moths? You're joking.
She smiled.
Their silk is just as warm as it is light. Try it yourself.
Keeping a safe distance from the hawk, Kuwain approached.
Would a song be soothing to you?
Please,
Rhea answered.
It reminds me of all the times you sang to me when I was small.
Kuwain nodded, her teardrop eyes expressionless.
I will sing you a song that used to help you sleep.
As she passed a thin hand over the glowing beetles, their light dimmed. Then, like an old tree weaving in the wind, Kuwain began to project a rolling, vibrating sound. It swelled and faded, repeating a comforting pattern over and over again. Almost a voice, yet not quite a voice, the sound wound wordlessly around us, coaxing us to relax, to let go. I pulled the blanket over my chest and leaned back in the chair, my eyes feeling heavy. Rhea, I could tell, was already asleep, and even Trouble's head had drooped low on his chest. I watched Kuwain's flowing motions for a while, but it was not long before I, too, drifted into slumber. I dreamed that I lay alone, fast asleep, in a deep forest. Tall trees surrounded me, weaving in the wind. Honey from somewhere dripped into my mouth. Then all at once, enemies appeared. I couldn't see them, but I could feel them. They were hiding in the trees, or perhaps they were the trees themselves. Worse yet, as hard as I tried, I couldn't wake up, not even to protect myself. Slowly, one of the thin, twisted trees nearby bent down over my sleeping form, slipping a finger-like branch into my tunic. The Galator! It wants the Galator! With a supreme effort, I managed to rouse myself. I was still sitting in the chair by the dimly glowing hearth. The silk blanket had fallen to the floor beside me. I reached for the Galator and, to my relief, felt it was still there under my tunic. Listening, I heard the sporadic chattering of birds outside telling me that sunrise was an hour or so away. Rhea slept, curled as tight as a ball in her chair, while Kuain lay snoring on the floor by the cabinet. Trouble sat on my shoulder, his yellow-rimmed eyes wide open. I wondered whether Arbasa itself ever slept. Even now, as it held us in its arms, was it still watching the hawk with concern? I wished I could ask the great tree whether Finkaira held the answers to my questions. Had the time come to leave Druma Wood and explore other parts of this island? Or should I be building a boat to search for another place entirely? I sighed, for I knew once again in that hour before dawn how little I really did know. Chapter 17. The Akhlia Bird. Kriya shrieked suddenly. She sat rigid in her chair, not moving, not breathing. Even the golden light of sunrise, pouring through the window slats and over her suit of leafy vines, could not hide the look of terror on her face. I bounced out of my chair. "What's wrong?" Her wide eyes peered into mine.
"Everything."
"What do you mean?" She shook the forest of curls on her head.
"A dream, so real, like it was truly happening."
She took a deep breath.
"It frightened me."
I watched her, remembering my own dream. Kuain's slender form approached.
"What dream was this?"
Kriya faced her.
"Every night I dream about the Druma, without fail."
"So? I do as well."
"It's always safe, always comforting, always home. Even when I go to sleep worried about the troubles in other parts of Finkaira, which happens more and more, I know I can always find peace in my dreams of the Druma."
Kuain wrung her knobby hands.
"You don't seem so peaceful now."
"I'm not."
Rhea's eyes filled with terror again.
"Last night I dreamed that the whole Druma, all the trees, the ferns, the animals, the stones, started bleeding, bleeding to death. I tried and tried, but I couldn't do anything to stop it. The forest was dying. The sky darkened. Everything turned the color of dried blood, the color of..."
"Rust," I finished. "Same as the other side of the river." She nodded grimly, then lifted herself from her chair and strode to the eastern wall, where rays of lavender and pink now mixed with gold. Propping her hands on both sides of a slat, she gazed at the dawn.
"For months, I've tried to convince myself that the sickness across the river unceasing would never reach the Druma, that only the blighted lands would fall, not the whole of Finkaira."
"So wrong,"
put in Kuain.
"In all my years, which are now so very many, I have never felt the Druma in such danger. Never. If we are to survive, we need new strength from whatever source."
The last phrase rang rather ominously, though I was not sure why. Rhea's brow creased.
"That That, too, was part of my dream.
She paused, thinking.
A stranger came into the forest. A stranger who knew no one at all. He had some sort of power.
She swung around to face me.
And he, and only he, could save the Druma.
I blanched. Me?
I'm not sure. I woke up before I could see his face.
Well, I'm not your savior, that's certain. She watched me closely, though she didn't say anything. Trouble's talons squeezed tighter on my shoulder. I turned from Hria to Kuain and back to Hria. You're mistaken, badly mistaken. Once I had... But I can't do anything like that. And even if I could, I have my own quest to follow. I shook my left arm. Despite this bird on me.
Your own quest?
Demanded Kuain.
So you care nothing for others?
I didn't say that.
But you did.
Rhea looked at me sharply.
You care about your own quest more than you care about the Druma.
If you put it that way, yes. My cheeks burned. Don't you understand? I have to find my own past, my own name. The last thing I need is to get caught up in whatever is happening here. You can't ask me to give up my quest just because you had one bad dream. She glared at me.
And how far would your quest have gone if the Druma had not been kind to you?
Far enough. I got here on my own, didn't I?
You remind me of a baby who says he fed himself on his own.
I am no baby. Rhea sucked in her breath.
Listen, I'm the only creature of my kind who lives in this forest. No other woman or man or child can be found here, except for the rare outsider who slips through as you did. But do I think even for an instant that I live here alone? That I could have survived without the others, like Arbasser or Kuain or the Achlia bird, whose beauty I treasure even if I should never be lucky enough to see it again. If the Druma is in trouble, then all of them are in trouble, and I'm in trouble too.
Imploringly, she opened her hands to me.
Please, will you help?
I looked away.
He will not help us,
spat Kuain. Hria strode to the stairway entrance.
Come, I want you to see what else will die if the Druma dies.
As she started down the stairs within Arbasa's trunk, I followed her, but only reluctantly, for the feeling was growing inside me that my own quest must take me elsewhere, to other parts of Finkaira, and perhaps beyond. In any case, to places far from the Druma. And even if I stayed here for a while, how could I try to help Rhea without being tempted to call on my forbidden powers? I shook my head, certain that our new friendship was already lost. I glanced over my shoulder at Kuain. She showed no emotion at my departure, with one exception. Her teardrop eyes glared at trouble, making clear that she was glad to see the irascible bird go. As if in response, he lifted one leg and raked his talons savagely in her direction.